This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Welcome to episode 55 of The Rex Chapman Show with my super dope homeboy from Lextown, Josh Hopkins. How are you, Josh Hopkins?
I'm good, Rex Everett Chapman. What's been happening?
I'm just hanging back in Brooklyn. Are you in, it looks like you're in Austin.
Yep, I'm back in Austin.
Nice.
It's cooled off a little. It's only like 96.
Oh, yeah.
So everybody's putting
mild
on a jacket. Yeah, yeah.
It's mild, really mild.
Mm-hmm.
Episode 55. 55.
Double nickels.
Any famous 55s you can think of from
Well,
history?
One that always jumps out at me is Cedric Swoop Jenkins.
Cedric Swoop Jenkins,
mm-hmm,
with the tip in at the, my teammate, Cedric Swoop Jenkins, with
yep,
the tip in at the buzzer to beat Louisville, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I remember those guys, those teams. Like Richard Madison was my 42.
Oh, yeah, that's
so
right.
I remember the 55s.
Uh-huh, 55s. Junior Seau, 55.
Oh, yeah.
One of my faves, Dikembe Mutombo, 55. Both Jason Williams, white chocolate, and big Jason Williams, 55s, right?
Interesting.
Correct?
Yeah, interesting.
Another guy that came to mind was a guy named A.C. Earle. A.C. Earle played with the Celtics for a little while. He was number 55. Wouldn't be considered a great player. He was a great college player. A.C. Earle probably only averaged, I don't know, making it up, 8-9 points a game. He got 50 one night for the Celtics in one of the craziest A.C. Earle. Yeah, amazing.
He got 50.
Really, got 50. Yeah. I mean, shooters can get 50 if they get really hot.
But mm-hmm.
This was in an era when there weren't a lot of threes being. He was a post player. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you imagine that? He was just like, he never changed one thing after that game. He's like, oh, it's 7:22. Time to get out with my left foot out first. Like,
no, he had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich that day. He ate one for the rest of his life every day.
Yeah, no doubt. Lance Ware, just won it on the current Kentucky team.
Lance Ware. Mm-hmm. Josh, before we get into our guest, and we've got a great guest today, Brett Favre in the news. Apparently, there was a welfare scam type fraud that happened in Mississippi, our poorest state in the country. And it's been found out that apparently Brett Favre was involved somehow from essentially money that was federal welfare money that was supposed to go to the poorest people in Mississippi had been diverted to some private individuals for other purposes. That's come out in the last day or two. What's your take? Anything?
I mean, it's just gross and it's sad, and you never want to see your heroes exposed.
I love that dude. He's like one of my top five all-time favorite quarterbacks.
Yeah, I mean, he was the gunslinger, and he just had that, you know, one of the last gun. Woo! That's what he seemed like, you know. And for this to happen, it sucks. Then also, you can't, sometimes you think there'll be some nuance with it. Like, well, you're reading a headline, but then you see the text message that's released and he's like, no one will find out, will they?
Yeah.
You know, okay, well then take it. And the governor's in on it, by the way, and divert it to a volleyball, some sort of
volleyball facility
at his
daughter's school.
But I will say, on the flip, nobody's really talked about how all he's done to further volleyball at his kid's school. You know, he really pushed them over the top.
That's right. That's
right. It's just gross. It's just sad and gross.
I hate it. I hate it.
Is he going to go to jail?
I don't know. I'm not somebody who's been in trouble like I have. I should know whether he's going to jail or not. I don't know. Part of me, I feel, just for anybody that gets in trouble, it sucks for you just as a person. Right. No matter, what you've done, it fucking sucks. You hope there's some kind of mitigating circumstance that, caused this to happen for him, some explanation. That's what you hope. If not, man, it sure doesn't look good, right?
I mean, what could it be in this?
What could it be?
You yeah. try and think of that, but yeah. It's sad.
It's tough. All right. Well, look, we've got a great guest today, and I want to get right.
Did you read anything this week?
Oh, shoot. Book club.
Let's do a book club.
I didn't read anything. Nothing. Did you?
No, I didn't either. That's been book club. Now, who do we got today?
We have writer for The Atlantic, host of Jemele Hill Unbothered, Emmy Award winner, author, and everything else, Jemele Juanita Hill. Welcome.
Wow, you really put my government name out there. Dang, Rex. It be your own people every time. Every time. I'm doing well. Did we have the briefest teammate run ever?
You're kind of like Steve Nash and Dwight Howard. There for a little, just a split second. I get people asking all the time, how's the CNN Plus show going, huh?
Same.
Do the banks still work out there? Still getting checks?
Oh, yeah. It may sound ridiculous to people. And hence, listen, we are in a privileged position. And this often happens when your talent is that, for you, the contract is the contract. So when people were getting their, jollies and laughing at, you got a lot of it. I got a lot of it because we're very vocal and outspoken on a lot of, social issues, racial injustice. So people, when they saw that the network folded, they immediately ran to social media to make fun of us and talk about how we were fired. And that is why I made the point of saying, I'm going to be straight. They still got to pay out this deal. Okay. So I'm getting paid to do nothing. I'm getting paid to not work. What you need to realize is that our presence impacts the lives of a lot of people, producers, assistant producers, directors, people's livelihoods are tied to our success and the success of this network. So while you may think it's cool to laugh at me, what about those people who don't have the contract that I have, who are not going to get paid once this is officially over? So yeah, I'm straight. The people I'm concerned about are the makeup artists and everybody else, the support staff, everybody else whose futures were totally impacted by the decision to fold this streaming service. So, yeah, I mean, it was unfortunate because I think, and you probably felt the same way, we had a lot of good content, a lot of good things that we wanted to do, but it is a part of the business. And it's unfortunate, but, we move on.
Yeah, but people don't know about, production. Those people all turn down other jobs. They clear their docket for this. So that really screws them. They don't get paid. And so you're right. I'm so glad you said that.
Yeah, because that was the case for several people on our show, people that were in other jobs that we convinced to come work with us. And because we had the desire to work together, and then suddenly it was gone. And I'm happy. It seems like most of the staff on our show, they were able to land on their feet, but it was very jarring for them. Very jarring.
Same here, because we had put out some episodes already and our team was great, and they'd come from all over, all over the country to take these jobs. And, the morning that everything broke, you were one of the first people that I saw. People were going at you on social media and all that. And you said, look, I'm going to be straight. And it kind of gave me, because I felt the same way. But I'm so new to a lot of this. Did it hurt your pride at all, even though it had nothing to do with any of that? Did it hurt your pride at all?
I think that's an important.
It does me a little bit.
I understand though, because people, again, especially tying back to the things you tend to speak about, people are rooting for you to fail. You know, to your point, it didn't hurt me because I guess I'd sort of been through this before. You know, when I left SportsCenter and when I left ESPN, so many people were like, oh, you got fired. They kicked you out. You know, no, I chose to leave SportsCenter. I chose to leave ESPN. It was my decision. And this sort of fed a perception, I guess, that people have that, you know, that I get fired from things or because of my personal beliefs that is a roadblock to me having career success when it's been, frankly, nothing but a help that people know where I stand, know what I'm about, know where my integrity is. So personally, it didn't hurt, I think, because I am juggling about 25 jobs. So I was like, this is one less thing kind of off the checklist. No disrespect to CNN, but this is like one less thing that I have to do. And so, I didn't feel that way. I felt mostly bad for the staff. Disappointed. Both Carrie and I were disappointed because we had already started to bank content and great interviews and really cool stuff that we were doing that people will never get to see.
Steph Curry's record-breaking three-pointer, Jason Tatum's buzzer-beating alley-oop, Ja Morant's poster dunk. NBA Top Shot is where the greatest moments from NBA history are turned into officially licensed digital collectibles. NBA Top Shot has evolved trading cards by making it easier to buy, sell, and collect by removing the hassle of grading, shoeboxes, and shipping fees. You can buy or sell moments in a few clicks and access them at any time on your phone or computer. Your collection is always at your fingertips. Start collecting Top Shot moments in any way you want. Collect rookie moments from future stars like Evan Mobley and Cade Cunningham. Collect throwback moments from former NBA stars like Shaq and Allen Iverson. Or collect moments from your favorite team to gain access to exclusive perks. Grab your starter pack today and Top Shot will give you $20 back to start your collection and pick up some of your favorite moments in the marketplace. Go to about.nbatopshot.com/bballnews and get in the game today. So growing up in Detroit, in Michigan, did you play sports? Did you play sports and how did that grow into you wanting to sort of follow sports and journalism?
So, yes, I did play sports. I love sports. I mean, I was the neighborhood tomboy, loved watching sports, playing sports. The sport I actually gravitated the most toward was baseball. And so I played fast pitch softball in high school, played it. I had to start with slow pitch. And then as I got better, you know, made the transition into fast pitch softball and played on some travel teams and, you know, got some interest from some smaller schools and I played shortstop. And so I was really into baseball growing up. It was probably my favorite sport. I was all right. I wasn't getting thrown out. You know, the lateral quickness was there, you know, at that time. So I was pretty good. And I was a good hitter as well. And so because I batted cleanup when I was in high school. And I right handed. Yep. Strong righty. And so, you know, had a pretty good arm. I like to mess with my husband and tell him, you know, I got the best arm in the house, right? Okay. Just so you know. So I was always attracted to sports. Like people asked me when I fell in love with sports and I was like, I don't even remember the process. It was so natural for me to love the game and not just baseball. Of course, you know, college basketball, college football, the NFL, like I just really absorbed and loved it all. The other thing I loved to do was read. I was a voracious reader, loved language. You know, I couldn't do math, so I guess my brain was like, we know you can't deal with math or science. We got one other option left, like reading, English, language, that kind of thing. So had a library card, spent a lot of time in the school library, read books on my own. Big Beverly Cleary fan, you know, Judy Blume, all of those sort of young adult novels. Choose Your Own Adventure. I used to get down on some Choose Your Own Adventure. These kids don't know about that. And so I love the storytelling. So I was attracted to writing and storytelling. And back then, as you know, as you both know, is that the only way you could really keep up in with your sports team was to read the newspaper. You read the sports section. And so I started reading newspapers because I was trying to follow my favorite teams. And somehow it just kind of clicked that I could write about sports. And I made that decision. I wanted to pursue a sports journalism career. I was very specific when I was in high school. And I started writing for my high school newspaper. I did an apprenticeship program with the local paper, the Detroit Free Press, that kind of changed the course of my life. I joined the National Association of Black Journalists when I was a teenager. And I knew to do this because, and this is why mentorship is important. And I know sometimes that, especially with young people, it could seem like we're not listening, and then something sticks, and then it just stays with you. So the apprenticeship program, I applied to this. I think I was a rising junior at this point, so this was before my senior year, and it was a very simple program that the Detroit Free Press offered. They took 10 Detroit high school area students. You did a 6-week apprenticeship program. They taught you about journalism, about what it meant to be in the business, learn the ins and outs of how to interview people, how to report, how to put together a story. And I was assigned two mentors who I'm still friends with to this day. And the woman who ran the program, Dr. Louise Reed Ritchie is her name. She was a drill sergeant. She was on us. And she told us, you got to have internships, you got to have clips. And she was the one that marched us all down to the NABJ convention, which was in Detroit that same summer. She made us a I'm telling you, man, she was on it. She knew. She made us apply. She made us become student members of the organization. She made us hand out our resumes to people we did not know and introduce ourselves. And I would have to say, hi, my name is Jamel Hill, and I am a junior at Mumford High School, and I want to be a journalist. I had to do that like dozens of times and hand them a resume that, well, thank you. Yeah, yeah. And she showed me. She showed me. Yeah, she definitely showed me. And after the apprenticeship was over, I applied for a job in the sports department at the Free Press to answer phones and to do to answer phones specifically on Thursday and Friday nights, because those were big high school sports nights, especially during football season and obviously during basketball season. And what you did is the coaches would call in with a summary of what happened in their game, and I'd have to write up a little paragraph that said, you know, Greg Smith scored 25 points, had 10 rebounds as Detroit Cass Tech beat Detroit Cooley 110-84. And these summaries would appear in the paper the next day. And so I was getting the experience of what it was like to work in the sports department, what it was like to write. And I'm, you know, 16, 17 years old getting this. So I knew I wanted to major in journalism. A lot of people at the Free Press went to Michigan State. They put the full court press on me to go to Michigan State, even though I did get accepted into Michigan and wanted to go there. But Michigan was ending their journalism program and making everybody an English major. And I was like, I want to go someplace that has a strong journalism reputation. And it was Michigan State. So I went there, majored in journalism, worked at my college newspaper all 4 years, had a bunch of internships. And I have been really blessed because I've been getting paid to write since I was 16 years old. Yeah.
Growing up in Michigan, Josh and I are both from Kentucky. How old were you when you knew or became aware that some of the curriculum that we were getting in public schools, wasn't covering, it was being whitewashed, to put it. Did you have it? Any sort of epiphany, like, hey, and then how did you study? How did you learn? Did you take more courses in college to learn more than you got taught in public school?
So this is where I think and where I had an advantage. Detroit is probably currently the blackest city in America because it's over 80% black. It was that way when I was growing up. So I had all of my teachers were black. I mean, from elementary school to high school.
Did you have any, Josh? Growing up, I had one. Okay,
I had a couple when I went to Beaumont, the public school. Private.
Yeah.
So my sense of identity coming out of Detroit was strong. I was very rooted in that, and I think most Black teachers, to be honest, because they know about the deficiencies in terms of what we're taught about real history. Yeah. They make up for that. And in fact, when I was at high school, we offered an African American history course that I took.
And
that's what I learned about. That's where I learned about Black Wall Street. That's where I learned about, you know, Black cowboys. When I learned the total, I'm still in contact with my African American history teacher from there. His name is Mr. Fancher, Howard Fancher. Wow. Right, we're Facebook friends. And so because of that, I had a great sense of history. I mean, the books that they're trying to ban out, I read them all. I read Catcher in the Rye. I read, you know, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings and all these other, and James Baldwin and all these other great novels. Like, I read those in high school. And yes, I had AP English when I was in high school. But you were aware of the disparities, certainly in public education. Like, when I got to Michigan State, and I also became very aware of what white people weren't being taught. Right. Because my you know, Michigan State is obviously it's a PWI, predominantly white institution. My suite mates who were white, and they were from an area outside of Detroit called Sterling Heights. And growing up, we used to call it Sterling Whites because it was so many white people
This had to be eye opening, though. Right.
Oh, it was extremely eye opening. So I'm talking to them. They had never heard of Malcolm X. Never. And by that point, I'd read the autobiography. I was like, you never heard of Malcolm X. And they knew very little about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. They were like, I don't think we ever got the day off for that. They didn't know it was a holiday. I was like, how do you not know it's a holiday? Y'all was still going to school? Like, I was like, the math ain't math in here. And so we would get in these conversations, and they were literally taught nothing about Black people other than slavery, civil rights. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. solved it all, and here we are. That was it. And it taught me the disparities in not only what we were being taught, but how we were being taught. Because my high school, to my knowledge, I think we only had 3 AP courses. We had AP Physics, AP English, which I had, and I think they had an advanced placement math. That was it. Meanwhile, they're going to a school where it's AP History, it's AP courses abound, and you actually get more credit for taking those courses. And so that's why you have people who graduate with 4.2s and 4.4s and that kind of thing. And so I was like, okay, so they had way more resources and all of this, but yet what they learned was so incomplete. And I was really blessed because I had some fantastic teachers. And so I very much believe in the value of public education. And I could only imagine if we had the same resources that people in different zip codes had, the things that I would have learned. But certainly it was clear to me, and definitely in taking, you know, college courses, sort of what some of the deficiencies were in terms of what we were being taught. But, you know, luckily I'm a quick study. And so I was still able to keep up. I mean, my biggest issue was attendance, man. Because, like, you know how it is at college. Once you get on your own, it's like, you don't have mom waking you up at 6:30 in the morning or whatever. It's like, am I going to really try to get this 8 o'clock class? I don't know about today. I don't know if today's the day I'm going to show up.
You also find out if you're a self-starter. You know, you got to learn to be a self-starter. And that's not my strong suit. So
that's so interesting. I love the way you said that, because I never really related to myself, because it's true. I learned that there was slavery and, you know, and then there was German shepherds and water hoses. And then Dr. Martin Luther King, he solved it all. Hooray.
Right.
And
you probably learned about Rosa Parks, I'm guessing. Like, Rosa might have been mixed in there, right?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
But I remember you read, I've never been a voracious reader at even though we have a great segment on the show, Book Club, a lot of people are really tuning in for it. Yeah. But speaking of art like that, I didn't really know anything. And this is before your time, but Rex will remember this. Then the TV event Roots came on and it changed my entire life, because it was like, there were slaves and then and now we're all good. And it was like so horrifying. And that bit of art changed so many people's outlook and view. I mean, it didn't make it that everything's good, but it freaked me out so much. And I watched it with my parents, and it was, I couldn't believe it. So you reading me being dumb and watching TV still through
yeah,
art,
yeah.
you know, learned a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and that's why those stories being told are important, is that it gives people an understanding that there's pages and pages of things they have not been told, or to understand the gravity of what the transatlantic slave trade actually did. And I remember watching, you know, Roots 2, Roots, Eyes on the Prize, you know, these were all things that were great in terms of really giving a more complete version of history. And I find it so, I mean, it's shameful, of course, that's one word for it, but this attack on education and on, you know, this bogus boogeyman of critical race theory. The funny thing about it is that you could tell that those people haven't been to school in a long time, or that they don't, like, they weren't being taught that shit anyway. I was like, so all the things you're trying to ban, trust me, they weren't being taught. Like, you didn't have to literally do anything, okay? They were not being taught this at most high schools. They weren't. So it's like they're trying to ban something that they don't even know. I'm just like, you're trying to ban something. Like, trust me, most of the history teachers in a lot of these schools, because they're cracking down on schools where they are majority white communities, which I'm just like, do y'all really think that a teacher in your community is going to have entire course sections on slavery? Probably not. It's going to be a passing mention or a paragraph in the book. Like, so you're banning something that was never there. Congratulations.
Yeah.
You know, thinking about that. All right, Jamel, who's the most famous person you could think of from Kentucky ever in history?
Other than you?
No. Yeah. Yes.
There's one above person. All. And when he says it, you'll be like, Colonel Sanders.
Oh, that I probably.
Just kidding.
I know it's a made up dude. I know it's a fictional character. I was like, oh, is the person who invented it from Kentucky?
No,
who am I missing?
One.
Who am I not? Uh-oh.
Muhammad Ali. Okay. So.
Oh, yes. That's
okay,
right.
All right.
Duh.
Yeah.
Muhammad
yeah.
Ali.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
So that it's so great, though. But Josh and I grew up in Kentucky. I grew up in the late 60s, early 70s, watching him fight and could not understand how he was more beloved and more popular outside Kentucky.
Crazy.
Than wow, he was in Kentucky.
Yeah.
Nobody ever talked about him. And if they did, it was about being a draft dodger or whatever. And oh, nope, they liked him when he was Cassius Clay, but not after he became Muhammad Ali. And I can remember just being so confused about that growing up, right? Josh, weren't you?
Oh, yeah, I did. You know, I was I'm about 3 years younger than you, and those years make a difference at that point. I just remember watching him and some kids not liking him. My father saying, I love him. I go, well, he talks a lot. He goes, yeah, but he backs it up. And then I was in love, too. But yeah, being in the South, being from his home state, and then not being revered by the people around you as much as he was celebrated, you know, through the media was really weird.
Yeah. And you all saw another change, because I think it's a worthy observation that once his health began to fail, he became even more beloved. And this is at a time where he wasn't as vocal as he used to be. And I had the pleasure, he could talk less. And I had the pleasure of meeting him. In fact, the picture is in my living room. Muhammad Ali actually kissed me during a picture. And I have that in my living room or whatever. And my husband likes to mess with me. And he's just like, I can't believe I've allowed you to have a picture of another man kissing you in our living room. I was like, well, it's Muhammad Ali. So, yeah. And I have another photo that I got that I bought on a cruise ship of all places in their art gallery of him and Ken Norton. And it's and them. They're in Yankee Stadium. And so they've done a photo shoot there. And the photo is fabulous. So I say, and Joe Louis's fist, of course, that's in my living room, being from Detroit. But, you know, I think what you said is really important, you know, Rex. And it's why I'm really thankful, frankly, that I did grow up in a majority black city where my identity and being comfortable and rooted in my blackness was a part of the daily experience. Growing up and getting a sense of who you are and being able to carry that in mostly white spaces from a confidence standpoint was very key and significant in my maturation. So when people ask me like, oh, how are you so outspoken and this and that, I was like, I have literally been the same way my whole life. I mean,
is this why you have so many haters?
I do. I think it's just, and I feel like I don't really say controversial things. I say things that I feel like are right in front of everybody's face, you know, because even things that are truthful. And that's a big part of being a journalist is why I was drawn
to it. It's just that you're saying them.
It's just that I'm saying them out loud. Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I'm saying them and very rooted in understanding how systems work and how they disenfranchise and oppress and all of these things. And it was one of the main reasons I was attracted to journalism is that there's a truth that's there that you have to tell because it's your responsibility. I mean, an oath, I should say, an unofficial oath of our profession, and I heard it a lot in college, was the role of a journalist is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. That was the whole point. Journalists are supposed to be the watchdogs of society. That's how it started. That's its roots. And it is why it's so heartbreaking and painful for me to see where the state of the media is right now, because it's very corporatized. And you have the people who are in charge of the major outlets, you know where their political beliefs are, and they infuse that in the properties that they buy, the media properties that they own and buy and operate. And to hear journalists, and this is why in a way, of course, I mean, if he could have never been president, that would have been much more preferable. But Donald Trump exposed all of the media's weaknesses, exposed them in a way that I hadn't seen quite done in my lifetime. And when you can't openly say the president is lying, when you can't use the word lie and you try to dance around it with mistruths or he said this, but it was this, it's like he's a liar. And as a journalist, you're supposed to be able to say that. And seeing all the hand-wringing and for years journalists ignoring what was happening, the depth of a very conscious white supremacy movement in this country that was being back supported and advanced by the president, to not be able or to really be in a crippled state to where they were unable to put that moment into context and to really spell it out for people is the biggest failure I have ever seen in media in my lifetime.
Wow.
It's so true. In my lifetime, Jamel, I've never seen anyone more just openly racist in politics than I had. I saw a guy when I was little named J.B. Stoner. He was from Georgia and he was horrible. And I saw David Duke, and it's like David Duke became president. And, you know, you called it in real time. You know, there are many people that have been that said it, but that people just rolled over for him will never not be confounding. I want to get to your book. Mm-hmm. You got a great bookshelf behind you.
Can I ask one question real quick? I got to, because it's so the way things you're saying are so interesting to me. You know, the 24-hour cycle of news is just so bad for us, and you know, the media outlets, I'm right, I'm left. In a way, don't you think that sports media laid out the foundation for that? The 24/7 sports stuff, you know, immediately you had to have an opinion, bad, good, whatever, and you saw it in society. It's, you never heard people like, I hate Magic Johnson. Like, they're like, no, I'm their fan, I'm this fan. And now it's like people hate LeBron. For what? Just because they have to have these opinions and they get so angry, but they have no scope. So it happens in society now, and now they love Donald Trump more because they want to be right, or hate him and hate this, you know, fuck Joe Biden. Like, what? Don't you think the sports media lay that out in a way? Even so, they on the news, they have the little ticker of what's coming next. You know, it's like,
Josh, I think that's a great observation. And it's true, because it is. And like, you look at a show like, you know, First Take or ESPN as a network, which ushered in the debate show, really, in sports television. They invented it, perfected it. Like, ESPN brought that to media. other networks started to copy basically a First Take model, like CNN, Fox, you know, MSNBC. Everybody started to copy that model, because what changed is that viewers suddenly wanted to only go to networks or only go to certain shows that confirmed what they already believed. And that was not what journalism was supposed to do, is that we were supposed to lay it out. You decide based on the facts. Now, I understand that debate is very popular, and it's what we do with our friends all the time. And I think as an entertainment venue, that's okay. Like, that's, you know, that's the fun of sports, is saying, oh, this player deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. This player does. The barbershop argument, like, those are fun. But it can be incredibly dangerous in politics. It can be incredibly dangerous when these are things that impact people's lives. And it became about more opinion than providing news value for people, for doing the core tenets of the profession, which is to tell people things they didn't know, bring awareness to issues, hold those in power accountable. It became less about that and more about back and forth and argument and left and right and all those things. And the fact that we have a network like Fox News, because Fox News, you know, I remember when it wasn't like this. Like, I used to go on Fox News. And the day I stopped going on Fox News and I was like, I will never be on this network ever again, was after Sean Taylor was murdered. And I was on Bill O'Reilly. And he tried to paint this picture of Sean Taylor being a, you know, a thug and somebody who deserved to be killed in his own home. And I was like, this is the last time I will ever be on Fox News, because, you know, with his popularity and his success, and as that wave of that type of host started to gain a lot of traction, Fox News changed, and they're basically state-run media. They're no different than what you see in Russia. They're the same thing. They just, right? And so that's not journalism they're doing over there. I don't know what the fuck that is, but it's not journalism, and it hasn't been for a long time. And so the fact that we know that exists, and that's, and they're the most watched news network in America, which makes it even more dangerous, right? And so we have allowed an open view, a network, to radicalize an element that we know is extremely dangerous. And I think seeing that is, you know, the roots of it are where you said, like, it started in sports and other networks copied it because it became so attractive to viewers. Like, viewers love to see train wreck television, to be honest. They love to see people arguing. It's what they do. And unfortunately, when you're in that mode, the nuance of what you're talking about is lost. And people ask me all the time about whether or not I miss being on TV every day. I don't. And honestly, looking back on it, I don't know how I did it every day for like 5 years. Yeah, it is. And it's a lot. And you're just not, you know, none of my opinions were manufactured, but like, I'd be lying if I told you I cared about all the topics I talked about. Pretty much 70% of the topics we talked about, I didn't give a shit about. And so it was like, but you know what your viewers want to see. And you try to find, even in the 900th LeBron topic of the day, you try to find something that's interesting or that you can advance the conversation in some way. But I don't miss having to give my opinion all the time, particularly about things that I don't think are really that important.
Do you think it's too late, or is there a way to put the genie back in the bottle? Because now
that toothpaste is like not coming said, back in the tube. It's not coming back in the tube.
You talk about journalism and the integrity, and now all these shows, it's just op-ed the entire time on all of these networks, even if some are lying and some are not. Now, there's actual reporting, especially I love to watch the national news when it comes on. I love to watch PBS international news. But there's no way, there's nothing we can do to even try and get people towards the center.
I mean, there are things that can be done. The problem is that I don't know that people have the will to actually do it. I don't know that they want to do it. I think right now in this age of misinformation is what we're in. There was the age of the information age. We're in the opposite, okay? And because of the echo chamber that social media has allowed people to stay in and never have to challenge or never critique the things they think that they believe, or never be offered other information that may be either a counter or supplement even sometimes what they know. Like if you believe that horses can fly, you literally can stay in that echo chamber and go to the Horses Can Fly Network and then go to social media and go on the Horses Can Fly Facebook page and then only follow other Twitter followers. I mean, look, first of all, you know, of all the things that we have challenged in terms of beliefs, the one I never thought that was going to take hold were people out there actually believing the earth is flat. I was like, what are we doing? Like, but you can find on YouTube entire videos about the earth being flat. And I was like, people, what are we doing?
People think John F. Kennedy Jr. is going to come back and be president as a Republican.
This is crazy. And I was just like, wow, we are really in this kind of world now. And so I don't think we can reverse it. But what I think we can do is support the outlets and the people and the journalists who are still doing great journalism. A lot of local newspapers, local television stations, they're still doing great journalism. Unfortunately, they're having to do it on a shoestring budget. But you know, as we're recording this, if you look at one of the biggest stories in sports, Brett Favre, you know, basically being a fraud and financially assisting in Mississippi's government to rip off people who need welfare, like this whole welfare fraud scandal. Like that came to light because of original reporting, I believe, by Mississippi Today, which has been following this story for the whole time. And even what we know about the Jackson, Mississippi water crisis, that was us finding out about how dire the situation is in Jackson, where they don't have clean water, where, you know, people are turning on their faucets and it's brown water coming out. That was because of local independent reporting. So on one hand, while I'm with you, when I'm just like, boy, this place is the apocalypse. On the other hand, I see enough pockets of great journalism that gives me a little bit of hope that there are some people out there who still care about the integrity of this profession.
This podcast is brought to you by Branded Bills, the best place online for premium headwear and apparel. Branded Bills has hundreds of designs available, including our popular state collection, where you can show your pride with hats, shirts, hoodies, and more for all 50 states. Are you a company looking to brand your business? Branded Bills also offers custom apparel options that can meet your brand standards with fast turnaround and shipping. To shop or learn more, visit brandedbills.com today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Brett Favre thing is, we could spend a whole show on that.
Yeah, that's a conversation.
It's a really tough one. And, you know, I it's hard to wrap your head around. I want to get to your bookshelf back there with your Emmys. And you got your memoir Uphill coming out this October, Jamel. What piece of your life did you want to make sure you got to use your own words, you know, to share? And how important was it to write about the women in your family that raised you into the woman you've become?
So I think people will be really, I think, surprised by how I grew up. And, you know, people see you on television. They see you being a part of some success. And they don't know the backstory or what went into you getting to the place that you're at. I mean, a lot of people see you now, you know, Rex, and some are still unaware of some of the struggles that you've had to overcome personally. And I think, you know, I've joked about this, but it's true. It's like ESPN is maybe three chapters in this book and it's all at the end. So it's like, it's not even, you know, so if people are expecting like an entire book about my 12 years at ESPN, they're not going to get that. I was able to pretty much sum it up in 2.5-3 chapters. It's like, it's pretty much just where it is. The majority of my book is about, you know, growing up with parents who are recovering addicts, the, you know, the toll that took on me as a child. You know, my mother survived a great deal of sexual abuse, write a lot about that. And you know, growing up and living with somebody who was suffering from PTSD. We didn't know what that was then. She didn't know what that was then, but she was severely impacted, you know, by that. And so, you know, I came from a pretty tough background, and I think people probably didn't know that about me, or most people did not. And so, you know, I talk, you know, those experiences shaped me into who I am. It gave me a lot of drive and a lot of hunger to make sure that I made different choices and to make sure I was able to live the life that, if not for some personal choices combined with things that they had no control over, combined with being Black, impoverished, and growing up in Detroit, if not for some of those obstacles, they would have lived the life that I'm living now. And as much of the difficulties that both my mother and father and my grandmother all went through, is that the one piece of satisfaction I wanted to give them to know that what they poured into me worked. And so, so that's what this book is about. And I hope that for a lot of people who read it, that, you know, they're not only able to find out more about me than what they knew, but I hope they can understand the testimony of it. Is, hence why I laugh so hard when people accuse me of having a victim mentality or wanting to be a victim. I was like, you don't know my story. You have no idea. If that was really my mentality, I'd have laid down a long time ago. And so, it was a very difficult book to write because it did force me to revisit some incidents and some things that happened to me in my childhood that, frankly, I didn't really want to revisit.
I'm wondering, Jamel, because I can hear it in your words, but I can see it in your face. You know, there had to be a lot of tears writing this book in certain.
And
I also know, you know, anybody that's been to therapy whatsoever, it can be cathartic, but it's very painful thinking about memories you probably haven't thought about, and for reasons you haven't.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't that I didn't acknowledge that it happened. It's just that I didn't necessarily want to go back there because I didn't want to be put in that emotional place again. And I know that even when my husband read it, and he read one of the earlier editions of it, I mean, there were a lot of things I had never, or some things I had not discussed with him. Just, I mean, he knew the general story, but like specific incidents with him, I never discussed. You know, like one of the things I tell. It was two parts that were especially tough for me to write about in this book, which, by the way, I should mention, drops October 25th, but you can pre-order it wherever books are sold. But two of the, thank you, I'll make sure you get a copy. Two of the most challenging parts for me to write about was, you know, this, we lived in this very shitty apartment. And when, after my mother, she had gotten divorced. Our house had got foreclosed on. We were living in this terrible apartment that was on the west side of Detroit on Joy Road and Lauder. And the woman next door had gotten murdered. And who lived next door, she got murdered. And, you know, my mother was she was really struggling badly with addiction. She was addicted to pain pills. That was her preferred choice. And but she did dabble in other drugs. And on this particular night, she smoked some crack. And my mother showed me what the crack looked like. And she was like, I'm showing this to you because I don't want anyone to ever take advantage of you and you not know what this is. And she goes into this whole speech about how this is a dangerous and don't ever do it and don't ever turn to drugs. And I never saw her smoke it, but I know that's what she did. Right. And that's why she was showing it to me, because she had bought it. And the reason why she had is like that woman getting murdered. My mother, she was raped at gunpoint in Texas. We lived in Texas for a year, and she was kidnapped outside of her car going into her apartment by a serial rapist that was in the area. They never caught him. And for years, even though we moved back to Detroit, my mother lived in fear that her rapist would find her. And when that woman got murdered, it triggered everything from that incident that she never received any therapy about, that she never got any counseling for. And that's the reason. And so writing about that, and even had, you know, talking to my mother and having her unfortunately have to describe the details of her rape, was I knew the story. I had not revisited the story in a while. And that was very tough for me to write about. And so just thinking about putting myself in her shoes to further bring the emotion, frankly, to the pages so that people could understand that. And that's a story I had never shared. I mean, my husband knew that my mother had been, she was a rape survivor, but he didn't know the details. And the details are in the book. And so, you know, writing about that and writing about some other incidents that happened in my childhood were very, very tough.
I'm sitting here thinking, and just as a person who follows sports, grew up, you know, I want to be on the street in Smith, and I hope I can go to college and play on TV and all that stuff. What we don't realize, and, you know, I've known you for a few years, we don't know each other extremely well, but this is the most in-depth conversation you and I have ever had. And it reminds me, you know, Michael Jordan he wasn't just invented when he showed up at North Carolina. He's got 18 years that, you know, are filled with whatever it is, you know, all of our sports heroes, everyone has a backstory. And until you sit down with somebody, you can never understand how complicated and fascinating they are.
Yeah. I mean, it's also, you know, when you learn these things, you understand the makeup of a person. You know, Michael Jordan's a great example because him being cut from his high school team, he carried that with him forever. Yes, and it's what made him become one of, you know, the greatest athletes of all time, and certainly the greatest basketball player. So, it is another reason why I love sports. It is finding out those stories that define and shape people, because I knew I had my own story that defined and shaped me. So everybody has something that defines and shapes them, and how they come through it is the beautiful part, right? The part that we want to pay attention to and we want to learn. It's not about the details of what happened. It's about how you are able to come to a point where you overcome many of these things and many challenges that, frankly, a lot of us face.
Yeah. Jamel, we're going to let you get out of here in a second, but I just want to let you talk briefly. What was it like these past few weeks watching Serena finish up?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, and I don't know if you probably, I'm sure both of you have this feeling, is that it's really kind of surreal when the people you've grown up watching suddenly are retiring. And I'm like, and you know, what really makes me feel 7,000 years old is that their kids are playing. And I'm just like, oh my God, their kids are playing. And it's just like, you know, it makes me understand that as I was growing into my sports fandom, when you would hear, you know, the elders and older people be like, yeah, I remember when Bill Russell played. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then who knew that one day I'd be like, yes, I remember when Serena played. I remember when she debuted as a pro, and when she was just a little girl, her and Venus, when they arrived on the scene with the beads, you know, and their cornrows. And it was just shocking to see in a sport that white.
People don't understand, you know, unless you grew up really watching tennis and watching them at that age, people don't understand that Venus was the one for a minute. Remember?
Exactly.
You know, because Serena was a little girl, you know, she wasn't even to be taken seriously yet. But Venus, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, right?
Well, I know, but I looked at that and I'm like, Venus has handled that with such class.
Yes.
That's so difficult. And to, oh, you're not even this one. You know, she worked just as hard. She had and she was great. She's just, her little sister's the greatest of all time. And she's always handled that with such class. I thought about that with her watching Serena. Yeah.
And they're also, for them to maintain such incredible closeness, despite they've experienced different levels of success at different time. And like you said, like people, you know, to see them have grown the way that they have. Like Venus was the number one. They've both been the number one players in the world. They both, you know, won an incredible number of Grand Slams. But the person who did see it coming was Richard Williams. I mean, he told people and everybody thought he was nuts when he said that Serena was going to be better than Venus. He said that. And he said it multiple times. And he didn't say it as a diss, but he was like, y'all don't know what's coming next. And he said Serena is going to be the greatest to ever play. And, you know, pouring that kind of manifestation into your kids is like, you know, it was incredible for him to be somebody who learned how to play tennis watching videotapes.
I was out in LA 6, 7, 8 years ago and living out there and went to a high school ball game, a summer game. And Lonzo Ball was a junior, going into junior year. And I walked up to his dad afterwards and I said, he's got a real chance. He said, I know. Okay. All right. He knew.
Jamel, it doesn't get better too. It keeps going. I can remember when I was like, the NFL players are my age. And then they were a little younger. And then the guys retiring were my age. And now then coaches were my age. Now they're way younger. And this past year I was watching, I was like, the Hall of Fame inductees.
Yeah.
They're younger. Like, why God? Why?
it's wild. No, it is. And somebody, when I was a young sports writer, an older sports writer told me this. He said, you'll see it eventually. Because when I started as a professional, I was 21 years old. He was like, listen, you're young now, but let me tell you, it's going to get to a point where the athletes stay the same age and you keep getting older. He's like, because as long as you're covering these teams, like they're going to stay between 25 and 34 and you're going to be the one that your age keeps going up. All right. But in a way, though, I love to see it because it is, you literally are witnessing sports history, and it's great that, you know, people like us can really give context to the greatness that we've seen it, because we've seen it at every stage. Like we saw when, as you said, when Serena was just an afterthought to her becoming this. And so we can speak very, you know, intelligently about her brilliance. You know, I loved what Bill Russell meant to the game of basketball, but I never saw him play. You know, he was already done by the time I became a basketball fan. But I could tell you about Magic Johnson, right? Because I saw Magic from the start to the finish, okay? And understanding that road and, you know, and all of that. So I think that is probably the incredible thing about being a sports fan, because part of it is about oral history and about being around people who can help you understand what you saw. And so I consider that to be a blessing.
What's your favorite movie
ever? It's either one of the three. It's either Shawshank Redemption, The Color Purple, or Imitation of Life. That's it. Yeah.
Well, so, and you know the three. Not even.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I know. I'm like, I have no messing around. It's like, it's these three.
What about front row center for any musical act or singer or speaker, alive or dead, front row center?
Well, I've been fortunate. I saw Michael Jackson and Prince. Okay.
Ooh,
I've seen.
I did too.
Yeah.
I did too.
Yeah. Yeah. So I saw Michael and Prince and Beyonce, because she's in that category. I've seen Beyonce a billion times. Okay. But if I could see anybody, it'd be Whitney Houston. I really wish I would have seen Whitney Houston at the height of her superpowers. 1A would probably be Luther Vandross.
Ooh, now I saw Luther. Oh, I met Luther. Yeah, the best. Yeah, he did a concert one night in Phoenix when I was playing for the Suns and got to go back. I barely even remember. And the other great one, I was in college and got to meet Stevie Wonder and saw his concert at Rupp Arena.
I've seen Stevie in concert, but that's amazing. Yeah, amazing.
So good. Jamel Juanita Hill, thank you. Thank you for doing this. Come back again.
Oh, thank you, guys. Anytime, I will come back for sure. And I'll make sure you both get copies of Uphill. So thank you for having me.
Go
Thanks
Spartans.
For coming.
All right, see y'all.
I loved her before. I love her more now. How about you?
Same. And wow, she fits right into our theme of makes me feel like shit about myself. I mean, self-starter, a go-getter, someone who would not be denied. That's her.
The thing that I you know, and you know my daughters, Tatum, Tyson, and Kaylee, the thing that I love most, maybe most about Jemele, is her sense of self and her confidence and how she, I think, how she values herself. She doesn't let others do that. And I think that's exactly how we want our young, you know, daughters to grow up and have a very confident sense of who they are and what they are and where they come from. And Jemele came from incredibly tough circumstances, and to be as much of a sponge as she was, to have soaked that up and to be where she is today is a real testament to her
character. Yeah, very impressive. Yeah, I like her. I like her even more now. You're right. That's a good way to put it.
Well, bud, you know, you want to come back and do this again next week?
I do.
Okay, let's do that. Next time, we'll see you right back here for the next episode of the Rex Chapman Show with super dope Josh Hopkins, right here on basketballnews.com.